You're in the middle of nowhere, with the day fading to a pale band on the horizon. From the descending dark, a bus pulls up, brightly lit inside, but with no name, no destination. The door shuttles open before you. There is no driver. Do you climb aboard? Of course you do. It's why you're here. Welcome to the Gray Line. Tonight's journey will take us to Erie, Pennsylvania, a town well named, if not for its nearby lake, then for its proximity to certain ley lines of the unexplained. See that other passenger? The one a few seats back, her dark hair hanging over her young face, hiding it? Her only luggage, an antique papier-mâché clown mask? Don't stare, it isn't polite. The thing you should remember about her is that her name is Virginia, and her journey is only now beginning, thanks to the main focus of tonight's strange tale. Another woman at the other end of the age spectrum, widowed, salt of the earth, with a home curiously placed on one of the intersections between the golden years and the gray line.
Georgie liked to talk. Her husband, Bill, would often say,
"Georgie may only have a 5,000-word vocabulary, but she uses the whole thing once every hour."
Georgie didn't mind that he said that. What she did mind was that he'd died 9 years earlier. She minded because he was the one she'd mostly talked to. In his absence, Georgie talked to herself. Or, more accurately, she talked to everything and anything. She talked to her ferns and ficus when she watered them. Over afternoon tea, she talked to the Amana fridge and the radar range. She talked to the vacuum cleaner as she swept the stairs and the dining room rug. She talked to the toilet and the sink and the alarm clock and the dresser. She talked to her 1994 Crown Victoria whenever she took it out, which wasn't all that often anymore now that her eyes were going. She talked to her back garden, where she spent most of her days when the weather was nice, which was about half the year in Erie, Pennsylvania, where Georgie had lived her entire life. And she talked to the graves on the other side of the chain-link fence. Georgie knew that some people would think it was creepy having a graveyard behind their back garden. To her, Wintergreen Cemetery was a beautiful rolling estate, as pretty as any English garden she'd seen on TV. Ancient oaks stood sentinel throughout, shushing with the breeze. A stone mausoleum, half-robed in ivy, decorated the crest of the nearest hill. The scent of fresh-cut grass and the distant drone of lawnmowers was a constant companion on hot summer days. And over the years, the graves just beyond the fence had become so familiar to Georgie that she'd started thinking of them as her neighbors. The closest headstone was small and leaning, its edges weathered and pocked by decades of bitter northern winters. It was shaped like a wedge, its face angled away from her, making it anonymous, except for one detail. Carved onto the top was the shape of a stone lamb, lying down, its head lowered. Georgie's mother had told her once long ago that a lamb on a headstone meant that it was the grave of a child. Georgie told the stone lamb about her son, Trevor, who lived in California with his wife and twin boys.
"He programs websites. It's amazing work, and I can barely understand it whenever he talks about it,"
she explained with a sort of reverential awe as she deadheaded her peonies. The headstones were an attentive audience, silently enwrapped.
"But it keeps him out too much. Kim, that's his wife, Kim, says he doesn't come home till 8 or 9 some nights. But she keeps the twins up just so they can see him. I tell her, kids need their sleep. Why, when Trevor was their age, I had him in bed by 7:30 and not a minute later. Nobody seems to have bedtimes anymore. I just don't understand it. Although the twins are growing up so fast. I saw on the Facebook the other day that they were about to start preschool. Seems like they were just born last week."
And she went on like that, literally, for hours. The graves sat patiently in the afternoon sun, soaking up the heat, and then slowly releasing it again as the shadows crept out of the trees, and Georgie sat on the back patio, listening to the tune of the crickets, embroidering or doing crosswords, whenever her arthritis allowed. She was barely aware that she thought of the headstones as alive. That year, like every year, the summer waned and the peonies wilted and shed their petals. The leaves in the cemetery grew brilliant yellow and russet and dull brown. They fell in a silent cascade and carpeted the hills, blew and danced around the graves, drifted against the chain-link fence so that Georgie could barely see the little lamb statue some days. The air smelled of wood smoke and mossy damp and the winter to come. October came, and Georgie got into the Crown Victoria and drove it carefully to the Walgreens next to the library.
I think Halloween is my favorite holiday nowadays,
she told the steering wheel as she turned it sedately toward the dazzling autumn sun.
It used to be Christmas and no surprise there. The snow, the decorations, the carols, why, I still love it so. But Trevor won't be home this year for the holidays and that takes all the fun out of it. Why would they want to stay in California where they don't get a speck of snow on Christmas morning? I just don't understand it.
At Walgreens, Georgie filled her little cart with cardboard Halloween decorations. Happy pumpkins, black cats with lime green eyes, a grinning skeleton with articulated arms and legs for her front door. She bought several large bags of candy, making sure to get the really good stuff. The Reese's peanut butter cups, the full-sized Hershey's and Zagnuts and Butterfingers. And on a whim, she bought herself a costume. A peaked witch's hat made of black nylon and wire. She didn't usually dress up, but she was in the mood this season. Halloween was the one time of the year when people came to her door. They came in droves, and they were always so happy and festive when they rang her bell. The kids in their costumes, bouncing eagerly on their toes, bags outstretched. The parents hanging back by the sidewalk, flashlights in hand, smiling and proud, perhaps just a little tipsy. Georgie would talk to them all. She'd ask about their costumes and how old they were and what their favorite candy was. If they answered her and if she had some in the big bowl on the credenza next to the door, she would give them two. Back home that day, she hung the decorations in the living room window and chatted with the sofa. She told it about her plans for the St. Luke's bake sale. Snickerdoodles, of course. When she was finished, she sat on the back patio while dusk purpled the sky. She listened to the dead leaves as they chattered in the wind, piled against the fence, skittered around the graves. She told the headstones about the great price that she'd gotten on the candy because it was Double Coupon Tuesday, and she'd waited until the last few days before Halloween, because that's when everything went on sale anyway. Like always, the graves listened patiently. On Halloween night, Georgie put on her witch's hat, filled the huge candy bowl on the credenza, turned the TV to Channel 11, where an old black-and-white monster movie was playing, The Beast of Yucca Flats, which she remembered watching at the drive-in with Bill many decades earlier, and waited for the kids to ring her doorbell. The first ones arrived a little after six, while the sun was still scraping the treetops and the air was still toasty, smelling of hot dogs and bonfires.
Trick or treat!
The little figures shouted, their voices muffled behind plastic masks. Georgie was delighted.
Oh, just look at you. A little robot and a warrior and a ballet dancer.
The robot said that he was Iron Man. The girl in pink explained that she was a Power Ranger. Georgie told them all that it was simply marvelous. She waved to the parents and wished them a happy Halloween. Dozens arrived on her front stoop over the course of the next few hours, and Georgie talked to all of them, waved to their parents, asked what schools they went to, told them all to have a lovely night and to be safe and to not eat too much candy, always with a knowing wink. The sun went down, dragging a shroud of twilight behind it, and the wind turned restless, threaded with chill. The candy in Georgie's bowl dwindled away, whisked away piece by piece in 100 different directions, 100 different colorful bags and plastic pumpkins and brown paper sacks. The frequency of the doorbell rings diminished to a trickle. Georgie peered out into the night. Kids' voices still echoed from neighboring streets, but hers was empty. The movie finished and the early news started. Georgie turned off the TV. Sighing, her witch's hat still cocked on her carefully coiffed gray curls, she closed and locked the front door. There were perhaps a dozen pieces of candy still left in the bowl. They looked the way she felt, tired, belated, and a little forlorn. She picked out a Zagnut and held it. She wouldn't eat the whole thing, she decided. Just a few bites. The doorbell rang. Georgie jumped and dropped the Zagnut back into the bowl.
My heavens.
She smiled ruefully to herself as she reached for the doorknob, twisted the lock.
Do you think I hadn't been here all night answering this thing?
She swung open the door, ready to hear the common refrain from the small figure standing there, bag in hand. But the child on the stoop simply stared up at Georgie, her face entirely hidden behind a large, garish mask. Georgie's blood went cool at the sight. Her knees grew weak. That mask! It was a clown's face, apparently handmade from papier-mâché, but very old, such that the edges were frayed and the circus paint was worn to faint smudges and streaks. The thing was almost obscenely bumpy and warped, as if it had spent decades buried in a musty trunk, distorting, growing moldy, staring into shadows. The mouth smiled with inhuman banality. The eyes were squinted slits, black and empty. Georgie took an involuntary step backward. The girl took a tentative, compensating step forward, coming onto the threshold of the door. She moved timidly, but with a note of unmistakable temerity. Damp chill radiated from her in waves. Apart from the mask, her clothes were very old and very formal. An ivory dress, richly beaded and fringed with lace. The fabric was dank, heavy with mildew. It hung like seaweed from her thin body.
Where are your parents, sweetie?
Georgie managed, her voice an octave higher than normal. The clown mask didn't respond. The girl's eerily pale hands held a cloth sack. It looked like an old pillowcase with a rotten lace fringe. She lifted it weakly, almost hopelessly. Georgie whispered,
"Trick or treat?"
Her words became vapor in the suddenly frigid air. She looked aside at the candy bowl, and a gasp hitched painfully in her chest. She swayed on her heels. Her hand fluttered helplessly to her mouth. In the candy bowl, lying atop the remaining Zagnuts and Reese's, was a small china doll. It was sprawled on its back, arms and legs akimbo, dressed in a colorless frock and black patent leather shoes. The face, laced with cracks, stared beatifically up at Georgie. Georgie took the doll into her hands, carefully. It was faintly damp, lumpy with age. The head lolled, and she cradled it. She turned to the little girl standing in her doorway. The clown mask showed no emotion, but an air of bittersweet recognition seemed to emanate from the angle of it, from the tilt as it followed Georgie's hands. She willed herself to approach the little girl. The girl held open the mouth of the sack, her mask tilted down to watch. Carefully, Georgie laid the doll inside. The girl closed the sack over it. Haltingly, she retreated a single step. She stared up at Georgie again. Georgie blinked, then gave a little shrug. Her brain felt like it had been dosed with Novocaine.
"Are you?"
she asked tremulously, unsure she dared say it aloud.
Are you from?"
She gestured vaguely with her hand, cocked her head toward the backyard, toward the cemetery. The girl didn't respond with words. Her shoulders slackened slightly. Her chin drooped. Georgie could see the top of her head. Her hair was dark, carefully combed and parted down the center, but matted and dull, virtually glued to her white scalp. Georgie tried again, pressing a nervous hand to her throat.
I just I never thought.
But the girl turned away. Her head was still down. Her shoulders lax. The beading on her skirt glittered faintly. The back of her dress was crossed with huge, ugly, gaping slashes, matted brown, stained and thick with old blood. Georgie recoiled, her mouth drawing down in a frown of revulsion and dismay.
Wait,
she rasped, putting out her hand but not quite touching the pathetic figure. The girl stepped off the stoop, her cloth sack still held before her. The bulge of the doll's head bumped her hip. Darkness covered her as the wind gusted suddenly, capriciously, carrying grit and leaves around her in a miniature cyclone. When they fell away, the shadowy figure was gone. But Georgie could still smell her. She could still feel the deep chill of her presence in the front hall. And in the bowl next to the door, lying amidst the remaining Zagnuts and Hershey's, was a small, black, patent leather shoe. It had fallen off the China doll. Georgie put the shoe in an old jewelry box and hid it in the cupboard over the stove. She wasn't really sure why. Over the next few months, while the Christmas lights went up along the main street, then came down again as the snow fell, piled up, grew old and gray with slush, Georgie tried to tell herself that she hadn't seen the dead girl in her front hall at all. She tried to forget the tiny doll's shoe in the cabinet above her stove, or to lie to herself about where it had come from. It didn't work, mainly because Georgie didn't want it to work. Never once did she imagine that the girl had just been a prank, a particularly grotesque and imaginative costume intended to frighten her. Why would anyone go to the trouble to trick Georgie? She barely knew the local kids, apart from their brief appearances on her porch stoop every Halloween. No, she knew that the girl hadn't just been a neighborhood kid wearing a creepy antique mask. She had come from the cemetery. She had come from the Lamb's statue headstone. And she had come because Georgie had talked to her. Strangest of all, perhaps, Georgie realized that she wasn't much frightened by the idea. As a good Christian woman, she went to Mass at St. Luke's every week just like clockwork. She knew that there were no such things as zombies, not like in that terrible violent show on the AMC channel. She knew that the Bible said people would either go to heaven or hell come Judgment Day. But she also knew that Judgment Day hadn't happened yet. So, what were all those dead people doing until then? Maybe they were all just sort of asleep. Maybe they were caught in a kind of suspended nothing between death and the end of days. Except that Georgie had woken one of them up. She'd done it simply by talking to them, by treating them like they cared what she had to say, like they mattered. She didn't want to doubt the Halloween apparition, because more than anything, she wanted to believe that the graves really did hear her. She wanted to think that she wasn't alone. She wanted to think that she mattered too. So she simply adjusted to her new reality. It was surprisingly easy. There was simply no one there to tell her that she was crazy. Spring in Erie, Pennsylvania was never really a given, but sometime around late May that year it did eventually come. The icicles on Georgie's gutters bled away reluctantly. The muddy yard breathed deep and exhaled new grass, daffodils, and eventually dandelions and crabgrass, which Georgie methodically plucked with her weeder. She planted carrots, tomatoes, and cabbages. She tended her peonies. And she talked to the gravestones. She pulled one of the old metal patio chairs over to the fence and sat down with a glass of Lipton iced tea and told them about her day. She regaled the headstones with stories about Bill back in the day, about how he courted her in high school, wooed her in the back seat of his convertible, married her, and went to work as an engineer at the washing machine factory on the other side of town. She told the graves her worries and observations about Trevor, who promised to come sometime after Easter if he could get away, although Georgie wasn't holding her breath, and his wife Kim's new job at some tech startup, whatever that was, and the twins' new life of daycare and preschool. And she did a little research. First, she went for a walk in the cemetery. It was odd seeing her house from the other side of the fence. The rolling hills and stately oaks had become a nearly mythical tableau to her, like things seen through a magic mirror. She touched the rough bark of one of the trees, ran her fingertips over the sandpapery curves and angles of some of the headstones. Then she laid her hand on the bowed head of the stone lamb. The inscription was almost worn away. Only the main details were still legible. Virginia Olive Partridge, age 11. She had died in 1920. A few weeks later, Georgie drove over to the Walgreens for some TP and Lysol and cup of soups, and on a whim, stopped at the library next door. Patty Gwen was an old school friend who worked there. They hadn't kept up much, but Patty was friendly enough when Georgie approached the reference desk. She asked if she could look up some back issues of the Erie Times newspaper. Patty was happy to help. She showed Georgie how to use the old microfiche machine.
No budget to convert everything onto computers, so we'll probably be the last library in the world with this stuff on microfiche.
And even asked Georgie if she wanted a coffee or water. Georgie asked if there was hot tea, and Patty said sure there was, and went off to make a cup. Fortunately, the Erie Times News had been published since 1888. Georgie spent a few minutes shuffling through the little blue films, sorting them from a large manila envelope, until she found the sheet for 1920 and slotted it into the projector. 40 minutes later, with a mug of Celestial Seasonings Almond Sunset going cold next to her, she found what she was looking for. On October 1st, 1920, 1 month after her last birthday, Virginia Partridge hadn't come home from school. Almost 2 weeks later, her body was found by some fishermen, washed up below the docks on the rocky shore of Lake Erie. She'd been hacked more than a dozen times with a butcher knife or an axe, and mutilated in ways that the newspaper described as unfit for description to a peace-loving public. Her killer had not, at that time, been apprehended. Police speculated that the murderer was likely a dock worker or a transient, someone large, strong, and, quote, born of a savage hatred divorced from the brotherhood of mankind. It was doubtful, detectives suggested, that Virginia was the brute's first victim, and she would likely not be the last. Georgie scanned headlines through the following days and weeks, and then to the end of that year. She didn't come across any other news regarding poor Virginia Partridge. It was possible that her killer had been discovered in another state, thus earning less local coverage. It was also possible that he'd never been captured at all. Fortunately, there didn't seem to be any more headlines about brutal murders of young girls. Georgie thought of the girl standing on the threshold of her front hall. She thought of the hack marks slashed into the back of her dress and the bloody fabric dried and stiffened to muddy maroon. She considered asking Trevor to look Virginia up on the internet. Georgie herself could navigate Facebook on the little Mac laptop that he'd given her. He'd made a tab for it on her web browser. But anything else was beyond her. In the end, she decided not to ask for his help. He would want to know why she was interested. He would tell her that she was crazy, or worse, that she was showing signs of dementia, maybe even Alzheimer's. And really, she decided, she didn't need to know any more than she already did. The summer came and went with typical northern brevity, like a favored guest showing up late for a party only to leave before the dancing starts. In the third week of September, Trevor called to ask if Georgie would like to fly out to San Diego for Thanksgiving. Georgie reminded him that she'd never flown in her life and was terrified to try it now, especially after 9/11.
Mom, terrorists are like fashionistas.
Trevor sighed from the mint-green kitchen telephone.
They never wear the same suicide vest twice.
Don't make light. They bombed the World Trade Center twice.
He told her that airports were so secure now that a terrorist couldn't smuggle in so much as an illicit kumquat. And she told him that if he was so confident, then he should fly to Erie with Kim and the kids instead. That ended that, and Georgie went back to talking to her kitchen. October came once again, and Georgie put up her decorations. She took her witch's hat down from the top shelf of the hall closet. She even made an attempt at carving a pumpkin. That had always been Bill's job, ever since Trevor was little. Her jack-o'-lantern turned out crooked and simplistic, but she was still pretty proud of it. She decided to call it Arthur. On Halloween evening, while the sun was still up, she put a candle in Arthur and perched him on the corner of her stoop. Georgie realized that she was nervous. Or not nervous exactly, but brimming with tense electric anticipation, along with just a twinge of fear. The kids began ringing her doorbell, and she exclaimed over their costumes, dropped candy into their bags and plastic pumpkins, waved to their parents, and bid everyone a safe and happy night. It was cold this year, with a bitter wind coming in from the lake, herding gray clouds across the sky like reluctant steel wool sheep. The chill dampened the trick-or-treaters' enthusiasm. Georgie saw parents hurrying their kids along, holding hats and masks to heads and faces. By 9 o'clock, the doorbell had rung for the last time. The candy bowl was still half full. Virginia Partridge hadn't come. Georgie peered out through the rectangular windows set into her front door, looked up and down the street. The sky was a low call, full of dense motion. The trees buffeted with angry gusts. Telephone wires rippled and sang between their poles. At the nearby corner, a streetlight cast orange light down onto the empty intersection. Feeling a tense friction of disappointment and relief, Georgie locked the door. She carried the candy bowl into the dark kitchen, then stopped short with a gasp, her eyes snapping wide open. Her arms weakened, and the candy bowl dipped in her hands, spilling its contents. Candy bars scattered across the linoleum like chunky confetti. Standing just outside her back door was a tall, dark shape, perfectly motionless, silhouetted against the sheer curtains. Georgie's heart felt like a hummingbird in her throat. She willed herself to calm down, to break the vapor lock on her chest and take a breath. It came in a ragged wheeze, but she felt herself relax ever so slightly. She set the candy bowl aside on the table and approached the door. The figure might have been watching through the gap in the curtains. There was no way to tell. It didn't move. Trembling only slightly, Georgie reached to unbolt the lock, twisted the doorknob, and tugged. The figure was a man, or at least he used to be. He was tall but thin, with lank black hair, matted gray with filth. He wore a cheap flannel suit, so thin in places that it looked like brown tissue. It draped from his shoulders and hips as if from wire hangers. Covering his face was a badly made devil mask, all streaked red paint and heavy-handed black eyebrows, grinning lips and sneering, pointed nose. Pale yellow horns jutted crookedly from the temples. The eye holes were as black as midnight. He carried a canvas mailbag in his huge, fish-white hands. Uncertainly, he proffered it, tugging it open. Georgie realized that there was little to be afraid of in this figure. She even had an inkling of who it was. Fourth headstone out, the marble obelisk. She squinted her eyes a little and cocked her head.
Mr. Obi?
The figure didn't move, but there was a subtle hint of assent in the air. No sound of breathing came from behind the toothy devil face. Georgie turned to the candy bowl on the table. She wasn't exactly surprised to see that there was something else in it now. She blinked at it and frowned. It was a tarnished silver flask. Copper plate letters formed an engraved monogram on its belly. COE. She scooped it up, heard it slosh, regarded it in her hand with a wry smile. The corpse of Mr. Obi was waiting when she turned back. She dropped the flask into his bag. The mask looked down as it went in.
Honestly, Mr. Obie.
Georgie chided and clucked her tongue. A minute later, Mr. Obie was gone. Georgie locked the back door and went up to get ready for bed. She was just wriggling into her nightgown when the doorbell rang. It was Virginia Partridge. She looked exactly the same as last year. Her presence emanated the familiar pall of deathly cold. Her face was hidden by the same horrid papier-mâché clown mask. She held the ratty lace pillowcase in her small, pale hands. Georgie had to go to the kitchen to find the candy bowl. This time it contained a threadbare book, hardbound in green cloth. On the cover, curly Q words spelled out the title, Dorothy Dainty and the Stone House. When Georgie placed the book into her sack, Virginia sighed wistfully. The sound was like wind rattling bare winter branches. Without a word, the dead girl walked out into the darkness, her pale dress buffeting in the wind, its beads chittering, its lace hem batting her ankles. The hack marks on her back gaped like squinting black eyes, like humorless, toothless grins. A moment later, Georgie was alone on her stoop, clutching her house dress about her, straining her eyes at the dark. When she got up the next morning, somebody had smashed Arthur on the sidewalk. Georgie didn't much mind. Kids would be kids. Winter came and eventually went again. Spring thawed the ground and Georgie's garden came back to life. She added zucchini to the carrots, tomatoes, and cabbages. While cleaning out the garage, she came across an old plastic sunflower, another gift from Bill back when she'd first put in the garden. She staked it next to the chain-link fence across from her patio chair. It caught the breeze and spun, making happy little squeaks. Georgie thought Virginia might like it. And she spoke to the graves. Trevor got a promotion. He was training people to do what he used to do himself. He didn't love it, but it paid better. Kim's startup shut down. Such was the nature of things, Georgie figured. The twins were in first grade and doing well. Trevor promised that they would all come home for Christmas. Autumn shouldered summer out of the way too early, as usual, and the Halloween decorations went up. Georgie went to Walgreens and stocked up on candy. On Halloween night, she put on her witch's hat. The doorbell started to ring. The trick-or-treaters came and the candy in the bowl on the credenza trickled away into waiting bags and plastic pumpkins. But Virginia didn't come to visit Georgie that night. Two others did. One was an old woman in a fine black dress with a high ivory collar, something Georgie's mother would have worn to church on Christmas or to a funeral. Her face was hidden by a Venetian carnival mask, its gold paint flaked dull and burnished bronze. Glittering jewelry rattled from the woman's bony neck and wrists. She smelled of Chanel and rotten pumpkins. When Georgie turned to her candy bowl, a man's boutonniere lay in it. It was a white carnation, dried and pressed flat, as if between the pages of a book. Reverentially, the woman held out a turquoise beaded purse to accept it. The second visitor was a young boy, half her height. He wore a dingy corduroy jacket, white shirt, and gray pants. His feet were bare and dirty, as if he'd kicked off his burial shoes out of stubborn defiance. Invisible eyes peered up at her from a Richard Nixon mask. The plastic grin was as white as the moon. Georgie had expected a toy for him, but the candy bowl had instead produced a cheap digital watch, fake gold with an expansion band, now broken. The display was scuffed and dead. The boy looked down into his paper bag as Georgie dropped it in. For a long moment, he simply stared at the old watch. Then, as if fearing that Georgie might take it back, he jammed his fist inside, scooped up the watch, and bolted off into the dark, leaving his paper bag behind, blowing against Georgie's ankles. She had an idea that he'd run away because he didn't want her to see any tears, even despite the Nixon mask. The paper bag was from a grocery store called Food Town. The last food town had closed around the time Trevor graduated junior high school. Georgie folded the bag and put it in the cupboard over the stove alongside the patent leather doll's shoe. And life went on. Trevor did bring the family to Erie for Christmas, and they even stayed there in the house on Haas Street instead of at the Comfort Inn. The twins were growing up just as fast as the weeds in Georgie's backyard. She had a cancer scare that March, had a lumpectomy and some radiation, and the doctors said that she was probably fine. They scheduled an MRI for later that year just to be sure. When spring came, Georgie added cucumbers to her garden. She went into the cemetery to look at the headstones. Near her fence, she found a Letitia Combs, 1947, age 70, and a Daniel Nowak, 1975, age 8. She sat in her patio chair and talked to the headstones. The summer came and went like a passing train, seemingly unending until it was over, leaving only a wistful memory. And soon enough, Halloween came again. Every year, as the leaves drifted against the back fence and the wind turned restless, as the air filled with the whiff of chimney smoke and rotting apples, Halloween came. And with it came the dead that she'd awoken. Georgie met them usually at her front door after all the kids had gone home. Sometimes, if they were especially timid, they appeared at the kitchen entrance. They came in all shapes, ages, and stages of decomposition. Some of the fresher ones reeked so badly that Georgie breathed through her mouth so as not to offend them. The older ones smelled mainly of mildew and cinnamon. The oldest were mere bones and dry skin, skeletons shrink-wrapped in thin leather. But all of them wore masks, hiding the sad horror of their faces, as if ashamed of their own helpless decay. Each one carried a facsimile of a trick-or-treat bag, and all of the bags received something from the candy bowl. Sometimes they were favorite toys or mementos. Other times they were prized possessions, but most of the objects were completely inexplicable and random, at least to Georgie. An old movie ticket, a skeleton key on a rabbit's foot keychain, a stack of letters, a pocket knife. One overweight man in a rotted leisure suit and a Planet of the Apes mask had even received a bowling ball. Virginia Partridge didn't always come. But when she did, the candy bowl invariably offered her something new, something of apparent importance and sentiment. She always accepted it with mingled reverence and just the faintest air of disappointment. She was the only one who ever appeared more than once. Georgie got a little older and perhaps a little more muddled. She realized that she was forgetting things more often than she used to. She'd find herself in the Crown Victoria and forget, for a few worrisome moments, where she was heading. She adjusted to the idea that Trevor might be right. She was showing more than senior moments. She may not be able to stay in the old two-bedroom, one-bath on Haas Street forever. She knew that Trevor and Kim were looking into homes for her there in San Diego. She had decided that she wouldn't even fight them on it when the time came. She was tired. And she'd enjoy being nearer to Trevor, Kim, and the twins. But she would miss her old familiar house. She would pine for her comfortable, busy little backyard and garden. But mostly she would miss Halloween and the trick-or-treats of her new, silent friends. Until her last year in the house, when things took a decidedly unexpected turn. That Halloween, Georgie watched from the narrow windows of her front door as the night settled. The wind switched, and the kids wended their ways home with their freights of candy. The bowl on the credenza was completely empty but for a lone Snickers. Georgie turned off the light over her stoop. She'd come to understand that her nocturnal friends disliked it. The jack-o'-lantern she left lit, however. Its candlelight flickered, caged behind a conventionally toothy grin and triangle eyes. Georgie had gotten better at carving pumpkins over the last few years. This one she'd named Stanley. With the television off and only the living room lamp to keep her company, Georgie sat down on the sofa, folded her hands on her lap, and waited. Her peaked witch's hat had become a bit rumpled over the years, but she still wore it faithfully. Wind hooted in a drainpipe, rattled it against the house. Distant voices could still be heard laughing from nearby streets, but they soon faded. Night settled its grip firmly beyond Georgie's living room window. She waited. But no one came. After an hour, Georgie set her crossword aside and went to peer out the front door windows again. It was a crisp night, promising an early frost by morning. The wind twitched like a lion's tail in the trees and the telephone wires. Leaves skittered like startled rats beneath the street lamp on the corner. Georgie went to the kitchen. No one stood silhouetted in the glass of the back door. She twitched the curtains aside and looked across the yard toward the darkness of the cemetery. Nothing moved. She blew out a confused sigh. There was a pan in the sink from her dinner, along with her plate and silverware. She washed them. She wiped the counter and the stovetop. She didn't speak to the fridge, or the radar range, or the spider plant hanging by the window. She waited another half hour. Feeling a bit sad and confused, she climbed the stairs to get ready for bed. She was just stepping onto the landing when a knock came at the front door. Georgie paused, relieved but still confused. None of them had ever knocked before. They always rang the doorbell or just waited in the dark of the back patio for her to see them. It had been a heavy knock, hard enough to rattle the windows and vibrate the step beneath her foot. She hurried back down, turned on the living room light again, unbolted the front door, and eased it open. A push of icy, barren wind shoved the door aside, tugging it from her grip and bashing it against the stop. Georgie blinked and looked up at the figure that stood against the night sky, filling her doorway. He was uncommonly big, draped in a long, flapping pea coat and rough pants. He was fat and muscular, like a wild boar that had trained itself to stand upright and wear man clothes. The head was like a torpedo rising from the bulge of the neck. It was topped with a ragged crew cut, sparse and patchy on the mottled scalp. The man's hands were like anvils. They hung loose at his sides, decked in grimy work gloves. He wore a Casper the Friendly Ghost mask. It was crooked, ridiculously small on his massive, lumpy head. Georgie shook her head slowly and backed away.
"You,"
she breathed wonderingly.
"You're not one of mine."
The floor seemed to tilt away from her. The world bled gray all around, turning every shadow into a watching, hollow eye. Cold breath worked its insidious, snaking path into Georgie's mouth and nose, up the sleeves of her dress, down her collar. She was still shaking her head in deep, growing panic. With dawning certainty, she went on,
"You shouldn't be here. You don't belong."
The Casper mask was all wrong. It didn't belong to this beast. He had stolen it from some poor child. Or worse. With a sudden gasp of fear, Georgie whipped her head to look into the candy bowl. The knife was so large that its handle jutted up out of the side, a worn wooden haft studded with brass rivets. Georgie recognized it as a butcher's cleaver. The rectangular blade was large enough to dismember a cow. Its steel caught the moonlight, glinted through a hash of industrious scuffs and scratches. Georgie was still shaking her head, almost spastically now. Both hands flew to her mouth, cupped her chin to steady it. The figure in the doorway held out its massive gloved hands. And Georgie saw, of course, the gloves weren't grimed with mud. They were stiff with blood.
"No."
Georgie moaned through her fingers.
"Go away. You're evil."
The figure took a sudden stomping step over the threshold, shuddering the floor. It jutted its hands out again, nearly into Georgie's face. Georgie's knees shook. It was a wonder, she mused shrilly, that she didn't simply pass out from fear. She looked up at Casper's terrible, happy smile. Behind his chipper black eyes, the massive head loomed, seeming to brush the very ceiling. Terror-stricken, Georgie edged toward the candy bowl and raised her hand. It trembled violently, her fingers numb and fumbling. She reached into the bowl, felt the cold steel of the butcher's cleaver, then reached beneath it. Shaking badly, she withdrew the lone Snickers bar. She turned back to the hulking figure and held it out. He was gone. With a sudden suck of air and a piercing creak, the door whooshed shut in front of her, slamming hard enough to crack one of its narrow windows. The mirror over the credenza fell from the wall and shattered in its frame. Georgie's heart hammered in her thin chest. She stumbled backwards, dropping the Snickers, losing her balance, wielding one arm behind her for support. Her heel scraped on a shard of broken mirror, and she fell against the balustrade of the stairs, barely managing to keep her feet. Her witch's hat fell and bowled away across the entry. Georgie's face was a frowning rictus, wild-eyed with shock. Her gaze never left the darkened front door. As she watched, the bolt chocked firmly into place. And something thumped in the upstairs guest bedroom, heavy enough to send a tremor through the house. Georgie snapped her head upright, stared furiously up at the ceiling.
Trick or treat,
she thought helplessly.
The rules are so simple, anyone can understand them. If you don't give a treat, you get a trick.
Footsteps rocked across the upstairs floor, quick and heavy. Boots on carpet, then on the hardwood of the hall. Georgie uttered a breathless, wispy scream and scrambled upright, hurrying away from the stairs, aiming for the kitchen. She butted a hip painfully against the table and wheeled around, pressing her back against the sink. She considered a knife. They were right there in the wooden block next to the stove. She wasn't sure she could summon the strength or the brutality to use such a thing, but it was better than nothing. She reached for the largest knife in the block. Something banged against the window over the sink, startling Georgie so that she screamed again and recoiled, flailing into the center of the kitchen. A huge gloved hand was splayed against the window, silhouetted against the night sky. Ponderously, it curled into a fist, drew back, and hammered a knock, rattling the glass. It repeated this motion again and again.
You go away, horrible beast!
Georgie screamed shrilly, backing away, her knees trembling like harp strings.
You go away!
She reeled into the hall again and angled toward the living room. Something was coming down the chimney. It was incredible but undeniable. Old ash and dust sifted down in steady chunks, piling into the cold hearth. Heaving scrapes and scratches grew nearer from within. Georgie's heart felt like it would explode in her chest. The iron poker stood next to the hearth. She considered taking it, wielding it against the undead monster, but suddenly she understood that no weapon in her hand could hurt the thing. The living couldn't kill the dead. Instead, she backed away in stuttering, clumsy steps, gasping in terror. She spun and ran to the stairs, flung out a hand to the banister for support, willed herself to flee up the steps. She didn't know if she had the strength. Heavy boots clunked onto the wood of the landing just above. A bulky shadow loomed against the moonlight.
You go away, you murdering, awful monster!
Georgie screamed again, her voice failing, sinking helplessly against the balustrade.
Go away!
Behind Georgie, the doorbell chimed. The sudden, unexpected surprise of it made Georgie's mouth clamp shut. Her breath hitched firm in her chest, and the footsteps above froze. Georgie's breath came again, but in tiny, panting sips. Slowly, she turned her head, looked back toward the door. A small shape stood silhouetted just beyond the narrow windows. Georgie forced herself upright. Numb with horror, she shuffled weakly to the door. She unbolted it, wrapped her shaking hand around the knob, and tugged. The door swung open to reveal young Virginia Partridge. The familiar waft of cold air came in around her, sighing and drifting into the hall like mist floating up the stairs. Trembling and faint, unsure if she felt more relief or dismay, Georgie looked down at the dead girl. Virginia appeared the same as always, and yet, for the first time, her clown mask seemed more like a sad attempt at cheer than a parody of life. The mask tilted up to regard Georgie. The pale hands held out the ratty pillowcase one more time. Dreamily, as if in a trance, Georgie turned to the candy bowl, finally understanding. She nodded to herself. Her strength returned nominally. She raised her hand and curled her fingers around the handle of the cleaver. It was so heavy, so deliberate in its terrible purpose. The moon slid along the blade as Georgie turned with it. She showed it to Virginia. The girl didn't move. She gave no sign of either disappointment or eagerness. But she did hold open her sack and raise it to accept. Georgie lowered the cleaver into the old fabric and released it. Virginia didn't close the sack over it. Instead, slowly, she dipped one small hand into it. She found the wooden handle. Her fingers curled around it, tightened on it, hefted it out into the moonlight. She let the old pillowcase drop away around it. And now the clown mask didn't look like a parody at all. For the first time, Georgie sensed that its painted smile was absolutely genuine. Because the monster that had killed Virginia had taken a terrible risk in coming here tonight. It had risked confronting the one whose vengeance would not be denied. Georgie exhaled shakily.
Virginia?
She said the girl's name aloud for the first time, then stepped slightly aside. She raised one hand, gestured a welcome.
Would you like to come in?
The clown mask nodded once, meaningfully. The girl stepped across the threshold. With stately, deliberate grace, she crossed the entry, walked to the stairs, raised a foot, and began to climb. Her pale hand wafted along the polished banister. Her right arm cocked at the elbow, raising the cleaver. The hack marks in the back of her dress flexed and flowed as she climbed. And above her, in the darkness of the landing, something moaned. It was a sound of pure, mewling, ghostly terror. Heavy footsteps backed away, clumsily, haltingly. The scales were evened. The tables had turned. For the thing on the landing, there was no longer any escape. Georgie didn't want to watch. She mustered herself, hurried to the couch, hooked the Afghan off its armrest, and then stepped quickly out into the darkness of her stoop, easing the door shut behind her until it clicked. She sat there on the stoop, the Afghan wrapped around her shoulders, one hand resting on Stanley's flickering orange head, until almost 11. She heard nothing from within and knew that that was a blessing. When she crept back inside, she stopped in the entry and listened. The house was silent, but not in any foreboding way. She could hear the gentle tick of the clock in the kitchen, the rumble bump of the furnace cycling up beneath her feet, the occasional creak of the house settling toward winter. It was all over. Georgie could find no sign of the horrible man. The fireplace was perfectly clean. The kitchen window was unmarred. Even the framed mirror and the crack in the door glass had been mended. It was as if the monster had never been there at all. Or as if Virginia had politely cleaned up after him once her deed was done. Georgie went upstairs, achy, chilled, and exhausted, and knew that there would be no more trick-or-treating of the dead. That spring, Trevor made arrangements for Georgie to move to an assisted living home only a few miles from where he and the family lived. They promised to have her over often and to visit her even more. She knew that this was probably a bit optimistic, but accepted the sentiment graciously. With the help of some movers that Trevor hired for her, Georgie packed. When it came time to clean out the cupboard over the stove, she found the old Food Town bag. She decided that she didn't need it anymore and put it carefully in the trash. The old jewelry box was there as well. Georgie took it down and opened it to look at the patent leather doll's shoe. Only the shoe wasn't there. In its place in the box was a folded slip of paper, so old and decrepit that it threatened to come apart at the creases when she opened it. On it, in faded, blotchy ink, was a child's drawing of a black cat with wide, friendly eyes. Beneath this, in practiced, if unsteady, cursive, were the words,
"Dear Georgie, you need a pussycat to talk to. Love, Virginia."
Trevor was allergic to cats, but Trevor no longer lived with Georgie, did he? Shortly after moving into her immaculate new apartment, within sight of the Pacific Ocean and its fresh, salty breeze, so unlike the winds that had barreled across her old familiar Lake Erie, Georgie picked out a nice, tawny tomcat. She named him Arthur, after her first pumpkin.
And that, faithful traveler, brings us to tonight's final destination. Be sure to collect your luggage, should you have any, and please mind the closing doors. Thank you for traveling with us, and do remember, not every journey ends so conveniently. The next time you board with us, you may find yourself lost forever. Just one more tale told on the forgotten highways of the Gray Line. The Gray Line is produced by me, G. Norman Lippert. Trick or Treat of the Dead featured the voice talent of Joy Craig as Georgie, J.L. Lippert as Patty Gwen, and Greer Lippert as Virginia. Today's episode featured music by Kevin MacLeod, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution license. Subscribe to The Gray Line for regular stories from the forgotten highways of the beyond. And check out my novels, including my newest, Red Eye, available in print, ebook, and audio format on Amazon.com.